an antenna like that. Doctors and nurses and four-star generals included. It was a very democratic army, they said. Unc guessed that was a good way for an army to be. At the hospital, they gave Unc a small sample of the pain his antenna would stick him with if he ever did anything wrong. The pain was horrible. Unc was bound to admit that a soldier would be crazy not to do his duty at all times. At the hospital, they had said the most important rule of all was this one. Always obey a direct order without a moment's hesitation. Standing there in formation on the iron parade ground, Unc realized that he had a lot to relearn. At the hospital, they hadn't taught him everything there was to know about living. The antenna in his head brought him to attention again, and his mind went blank. Then the antenna put Unc at parade rest again, then at attention again, then made him give a rifle salute, then put him at ease again. His thinking began again. He caught another glimpse of the world around him. Life was like that, Unc told himself, tentatively. Blanks and glimpses, and now and then maybe that awful flash of pain for doing something wrong. A small, low-flying, fast-flying moon sailed in the violet sky overhead. Unc didn't know why he thought so, but he thought the moon was moving too fast. It didn't seem right. And the sky, he thought, should be blue instead of violet. Unc felt cold, too, and he longed for more warmth. The unending cold seemed as wrong, as unfair, somehow, as the fast moon and the violet sky. Unc's divisional commander was now talking to Unc's regimental commander. Unc's regimental commander spoke to Unc's battalion commander. Unc's battalion commander spoke to Unc's company commander. Unc's company commander spoke to Unc's platoon leader, who was Sergeant Brackman. Brackman came up to Unc and ordered him to march up to the man at the stake in a military manner and strangle him until he was dead. Brackman told Unc it was a direct order. So Unc did it. He marched up to the man at the stake. He marched in time to the dry, tinny music of one snare drum. The sound of the snare drum was really just in his head, coming from his antenna. Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a rented a tent. When Unc got to the man at the stake, Unc hesitated for just a second, because the red-haired man at the stake looked so unhappy. Then there was a tiny warning pain in Unc's head, like the first deep nip of a dentist's drill. Unc put his thumbs on the red-haired man's windpipe, and the pain stopped right away. Unc didn't press with his thumbs, because the man was trying to tell him something. Unc was puzzled by the man's silence, and then realized that the man's antenna must be keeping him silent, just as antennas were keeping all of the soldiers silent. Heroically, the man at the stake now overcame the will of his antenna and spoke rapidly, writhingly.
"Unc! Unc! Unc!"
he said, and the spasms of the fight between his own will and the will of the antenna made him repeat the name idiotically.
"Bluestone, Unc," he said. "Barrack 12! Letter!"
The warning pain nagged in Unc's head again. Dutifully, Unc strangled the man at the stake, choked him until the man's face was purple and his tongue stuck out. Unc stepped back, came to attention, did a smart about-face, and returned to his place in ranks, again accompanied by the snare drum in his head. Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a rented a tent. Sergeant Brackman nodded at Unc, winked affectionately. Again, 10,000 came to attention. Horribly, the dead man at the stake struggled to come to attention, too, rattling his chains. He failed to be a perfect soldier, not because he didn't want to be one, but because he was dead. Now the great formation broke up into rectangular components. These marched mindlessly away, each man hearing a snare drum in his head. An observer would have heard nothing but the tread of boots. An observer would have been at a loss as to who was really in charge, since even the generals moved like marionettes, keeping time to the idiotic words, "Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent." Chapter 5. Letter from an Unknown Hero.
We can make the center of a man's memory virtually as sterile as a scalpel fresh from the autoclave. But grains of new experience begin to accumulate on it at once. These grains, in turn, form themselves into patterns not necessarily favorable to military thinking. Unfortunately, this problem of recontamination seems insoluble.
Dr. Morris N. Castle, Director of Mental Health, Mars. Unk's formation halted before a granite barrack, before a barrack in a perspective of thousands, a perspective that ran to seeming infinity on the iron plain. Before every tenth barrack was a flagpole with a banner snapping in the keen wind. The banners were all different. The banner that fluttered like a guardian angel over Unk's company area was very gay. Red and white stripes, and many white stars on a field of blue. It was Old Glory, the flag of the United States of America on Earth. Down the line was the red banner of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Past that was a wonderful green, orange, yellow, and purple banner showing a lion holding a sword. It was the flag of Ceylon. And past that was a red ball on a white field, the flag of Japan. The banners signified the countries that various Martian units would attack and paralyze when the war between Mars and Earth began. Unk saw no banners until his antenna let his shoulders sag, let his joints loosen, let him fall out. He gawked at the long perspective of barracks and flagpoles. The barrack before which he stood had a large number painted over the door. The number was 576. Some part of Unk found the number fascinating, made Unk study it. Then he remembered the execution, remembered that the red-headed man he had killed had told him something about a blue stone and Barrack 12. Inside Barrack 576, Unk cleaned his rifle, found it an extremely pleasant thing to do. He found, moreover, that he still knew how to take the weapon apart. That much of his memory, at any rate, had not been wiped out at the hospital. It made him furtively happy to suspect that there were probably other parts of his memory that had been missed as well. Why this suspicion should make him furtively happy, he didn't know. He swabbed away at his rifle's bore. His weapon was an 11mm German Mauser, single shot, a type of rifle that made its reputation when used by the Spaniards in the Earthling Spanish-American War. All of the Martian Army's rifles were of about the same vintage. Martian agents, working quietly on Earth, had been able to buy up huge quantities of Mausers and British Enfields and American Springfields for next to nothing. Unk's squad mates were swabbing their bores, too. The oil smelled good, and the oily patches, twisting through the rifling, resisted the thrust of the cleaning rod just enough to be interesting. There was hardly any talk. No one seemed to have taken particular notice of the execution. If there had been a lesson in the execution for Unk's squad mates, they were finding the lesson as digestible as pablum. There had been only one comment on Unk's participation in the execution, and that had come from Sergeant Brackman.
"You done all right, Unk," said Brackman.
"Thanks," said Unk.
"This man done all right, didn't he?"
Brackman asked Unk's squadmates. There had been some nods, but Unk had the impression that his squadmates would have nodded in response to any positive question, would have shaken their heads in response to any negative one. Unk withdrew the rod and patch, slipped his thumb under the open breech, caught the sunlight on his oily thumbnail. The thumbnail sent the sunlight up the bore. Unk put his eye to the muzzle and was thrilled by perfect beauty. He could have stared happily at the immaculate spiral of the rifling for hours, dreaming of a happy land whose round gate he saw at the other end of the bore. The pink under his oily thumbnail at the far end of the barrel made that far end seem a rosy paradise indeed. Some day he was going to crawl down the barrel to that paradise. It would be warm there, and there would be only one moon, Unk thought, and the moon would be fat, stately, and slow. Something else about the pink paradise at the end of the barrel came to Unk, and Unk was puzzled by the clarity of the vision. There were three beautiful women in that paradise, and Unk knew exactly what they looked like. One was white, one was gold, and one was brown. The golden girl was smoking a cigarette in Unk's vision. Unk was further surprised to find that he even knew what kind of cigarette the golden girl was smoking. It was a moon mist cigarette.
"Sell moon mist," Unk said out loud. It felt good to say that. Felt authoritative. Shrewd.
"Huh?" said a young colored soldier, cleaning his rifle next to Unk. "What's that you say, Unk?" he said. He was 23 years old. His name was stitched in yellow on a black patch over his left breast pocket. Boaz was his name. If suspicions had been permitted in the Army of Mars, Boaz would have been a person to suspect. His rank was only private first class, but his uniform, though regulation like in green, was made from far finer stuff, and was much better tailored than the uniform of anyone around him, including the uniform of Sergeant Brackman. Everyone else's uniform was coarse, scratchy, held together by clumsy stitches of thick thread, and everyone else's uniform looked good only when the wearer stood at attention. In any other position, an ordinary soldier found that his uniform tended to bunch and crackle, as though made of paper. Boaz's uniform followed his every movement with silken grace. The stitches were numerous and tiny, and most puzzling of all, Boaz's shoes had a deep, rich, ruby luster, a luster that no other soldiers could achieve, no matter how much they might polish their shoes. Unlike the shoes of anyone else in the company area, the shoes of Boaz were genuine leather from Earth.
"You say something, Unk?" said Boaz.
"Dump moon mist. Get rid of it," murmured Unk.
The words made no sense to him. He had let them out simply because they had wanted out so badly.
"Sell," he said.
Boaz smiled, ruefully amused.
"Sell it, huh?" he said. "Okay, Unk. We sell it."
He raised an eyebrow.
"What we gonna sell, Unk?"
There was something particularly bright and piercing about the pupils of his eyes. Unk found this yellow brightness, this sharpness of Boaz's eyes, disquieting. Increasingly so, as Boaz continued to stare. Unk looked away, looked by chance into the eyes of some of his other squadmates, found their eyes to be uniformly dull. Even the eyes of Sergeant Brackman were dull. Boaz's eyes continued to bite into Unk. Unk felt compelled to meet their gaze again. The pupils were seeming diamonds.
"You don't remember me, Unk?" said Boaz.
The question alarmed Unk. For some reason, it was important that he not remember Boaz. He was grateful that he really didn't remember him.
"Boaz, Unk," said the colored man. "I'm Boaz."
Unk nodded.
"How do you do?" he said.
"Oh, I don't do what you'd call real bad,"
said Boaz. He shook his head.
"You don't remember nothing about me, Unk?"
"No,"
said Unk. His memory was nagging him a little now, telling him that he might remember something about Boaz if he tried as hard as he could. He shushed his memory.
"Sorry," said Unk. "My mind's a blank."
"You and me, we're buddies," said Boaz. "Boaz and Unk."
said Unc.
You remember what the buddy system is, Unc?
Said Boaz. No, said Unc.
Every man in every squad, said Boaz. He got a buddy. Buddies share the same foxhole, stick right close to each other in attacks, cover each other. One buddy get in trouble in hand-to-hand, the other buddy come up and help, slip a knife in.
Said Unc.
Funny, said Boaz, what a man'll forget in the hospital and what he'll still remember, no matter what they do. You and me, we trained as buddies for a whole year, and you done forgot that. And then you say that thing about cigarettes. What kind of cigarettes, Unc?
I forget, said Unc.
Try and remember now, said Boaz. You had it once.
He frowned and squinted, as though trying to help Unc remember.
I think it's so interesting what a man can remember after he's been to the hospital. Try and remember everything you can.
There was a certain effeminacy about Boaz, in the nature of a cunning bully's chucking a sissy under the chin, talking baby talk to him. But Boaz liked Unc. That was in his manner, too. Unc had the eerie feeling that he and Boaz were the only real people in the stone building, that the rest were glass-eyed robots, and not very well-made robots at that. Sergeant Brackman, supposedly in command, seemed no more alert, no more responsible, no more in command than a bag of wet feathers.
"Let's hear all you can remember, Unc," wheedled Boaz. "Old buddy," he said, "just remember all you can."
Before Unc could remember anything, the head pain that had made him get on with the execution hurt him again. The pain did not stop, however, with the warning nip. While Boaz watched expressionlessly, the pain in Unc's head became a wanging, flashing thing. Unc stood, dropped his rifle, clawed at his head, reeled, screamed, fainted. When Unc came to on the barrack floor, his buddy Boaz was daubing Unc's temples with a cold wash rag. Unc's squad mates stood in a circle around Unc and Boaz. The faces of their squad mates were unsurprised, unsympathetic. Their attitude was that Unc had done something stupid and unsoldierly, and so deserved what he got. They looked as though Unc had done something as militarily stupid as silhouetting himself against the sky, or cleaning a loaded weapon, as sneezing on patrol, or contracting and not reporting a venereal disease, as refusing a direct order, or sleeping through reveille, as being drunk on guard, or drawing to an inside straight, as keeping a book or a live hand grenade in his footlocker, as asking who had started the army anyway, and why. Boaz was the only one who looked sorry about what happened to Unc.
"It was all my fault, Unc," he said.
Sergeant Brackman now pushed through the circle, stood over Unc and Boaz.
"What'd he do, Boaz?" said Brackman.
"I was kidding him, Sergeant," said Boaz earnestly. "I told him to try and remember back as far as he could. I never dreamed he'd go and do it."
"Ought to have more sense than to kid a man just back from the hospital," said Brackman gruffly.
"Oh, I know it, said Boaz, full of remorse. "My buddy," he said, "God damn me."
"Unc," said Brackman, "didn't they tell you about remembering at the hospital?"
Unc shook his head vaguely.
"Maybe," he said. "They told me a lot."
"That's the worst thing you can do, Unc, remembering back," said Brackman. "That's what they put you in the hospital for in the first place, on account of you remembered too much."
He made cups of his stubby hands, held them in the heartbreaking problem Unc had been.
"Holy smokes," he said. "You were remembering so much, Unc, you weren't worth a nickel as a soldier."
Unc sat up, laid his hand on his breast, found that the front of his blouse was wet with tears. He thought of explaining to Brackman that he hadn't really tried to remember back, that he'd known instinctively that was a bad thing to do. But the pain had hit him anyway. He didn't tell Brackman that, for fear that the pain would come again. Unc groaned and blinked away the last of the tears. He wasn't going to do anything he wasn't ordered to do.
"As for you, Boaz," said Brackman, "I don't know but what a week's latrine duty would maybe teach you something about horseplay with people just out of the hospital."
Something formless in Unc's memory told Unc to watch the play-by-play between Brackman and Boaz closely. It was somehow important.
"A week, Sergeant?"
said Boaz.
"Yes, by God," said Brackman,
and then he shuddered and closed his eyes. Plainly, his antenna had just given him a little stab of pain.
"A whole week, Sarge?"
asked Boaz innocently.
"A day,"
said Brackman, and it was less a threat than a question. Again, Brackman reacted to pain in his head.
"Starting when, Sarge?"
asked Boaz. Brackman fluttered his stubby hands.
"Never mind," he said.
He looked rattled, betrayed, haunted. He lowered his head, as though better to fight the pain if it came again.
"No more horseplay, damn it,"
he said, his voice deep in his throat. He hurried away, hurried into his room at the end of the barrack, slammed the door. The company commander, a Captain Arnold Birch, came into the barrack for a surprise inspection. Boaz was the first to see him. Boaz did what a soldier was supposed to do under such circumstances. Boaz shouted,
"Attend, hut!"
Boaz did this as though he had no rank at all. It is a freak of military custom that the lowliest private can command his equals and non-commissioned superiors to attention, if he is the first to detect the presence of a commissioned officer in any roofed-over structure not in a combat area. The antennas of the enlisted men responded instantly, straightened the men's backs, locked their joints, hauled in their guts, tucked in their butts, made their minds go blank. Unc sprang up from the floor, stood stiff and shivering. Only one man was slow about coming to attention. That man was Boaz. And when he did come to attention, there was something almost insolent and loose and leering about the way he did it. Captain Birch, finding Boaz's attitude profoundly offensive, was about to speak to Boaz about it. But the captain no sooner got his mouth open than pain hit him between the eyes. The captain closed his mouth without having made a sound. Under the baleful gaze of Boaz, he came smartly to attention, did an about-face, heard a snare drum in his head, and marched out of the barrack in step with the drum. When the captain was gone, Boaz did not put his squadmates at ease again, though it was in his power to do so. He had a small control box in his right front trouser pocket that could make his squadmates do just about anything. The box was the size of a 1-pint hip flask. Like a hip flask, the box was curved to fit a body curve. Boaz chose to carry it on the hard, curved face of his thigh. The control box had 6 buttons and 4 knobs on it. By manipulating these, Boaz could control anybody who had an antenna in his skull. Boaz could administer pain in any amount to that anybody, could bring him to attention, could make him hear a snare drum, could make him march, halt, fall in, fall out, salute, attack, retreat, hop, skip, jump. Boaz had no antenna in his own skull. As free as it wanted to be. That's how free the free will of Boaz was. Boaz was one of the real commanders of the Army of Mars. He was in command of 1/10 of the force that was to attack the United States of America when the attack on Earth was mounted. Down the line were units training to attack Russia, Switzerland, Japan, Australia, Mexico, China, Nepal, Uruguay. To the best of Boaz's knowledge, there were 800 real commanders of the Army of Mars, not one of them with an apparent rank above Buck Sergeant. The nominal commander of the entire army, General of the Army's Borders M. Pulsifer, was in fact controlled at all times by his orderly, Corporal Bert Wright. Corporal Wright, the perfect orderly, carried aspirin for the general's almost chronic headaches. The advantages of a system of secret commanders are obvious. Any rebellion within the army of Mars would be directed against the wrong people. And, in time of war, the enemy could exterminate the entire Martian officer class without disturbing the army of Mars in the least.
799,
said Boaz out loud, correcting his own understanding of the number of real commanders. One of the real commanders was dead, having been strangled at the stake by Unk. The strangled man had been Private Stony Stevenson, former real commander of a British attack unit. Stony had become so fascinated by Unk's struggles to understand what was going on that he had begun, unconsciously, to help Unk think. Stevenson had suffered the ultimate humiliation for this. An antenna had been installed in his skull, and he had been forced by it to march to the stake like a good soldier, there to await murder by his protégé. Boaz let his squadmates go on standing at attention, let them go on quivering, thinking nothing, seeing nothing. Boaz went to Unk's cot, lay down on it with his big, lustrous shoes on the brown blanket. He folded his hands behind his head, arched his body like a bow.
"Ah,"
said Boaz, somewhere between a yawn and a groan.
"Ah, now, men, he said, letting his mind idle. "Goddamn now, men," he said.
It was lazy nonsense talk. Boaz was a little bored with his toys. It occurred to him to have them fight each other, but the penalty for doing that, if he got caught, was the same penalty Stony Stevenson had paid.
"Ah, now, men. Really now, men," said Boaz languidly. "God damn it now, men," he said. "I got it made. You men got to admit that. Old Boaz is doing how you might say real fine."
He rolled off the bed, landed on all fours,